It's Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, new data show younger women in some big cities now earn slightly more than men of the same age. How much is changing in the fight for equal pay? Find out more today at 6 on 1A+. Now, we often celebrate creativity, but what if you feel like you're just not the creative type? Our next guest says, hey, you may not be giving yourself enough credit for the less obvious ways your creativity comes out. And he says creative people aren't just born that way. You can learn to be more creative, too. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What does creativity look like in your own life? Do you have a creative outlet, big or small? Has the pandemic led you to be more creative in your parenting, staying connected to loved ones, your work, how you have fun? How often do you go outside your comfort zone? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Matt Richtel is a science reporter for the New York Times. His new book out today is called Inspired, Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul. Matt, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. How are you?
Good. You've followed this subject for a long time. I've talked to you a little bit about creativity in the past. What is so interesting to you about figuring out our creativity?
Well, I'll give you a quick answer, and then I want to ask you a question and maybe ask listeners to do the same thing. Oh, yeah.
I asked the questions here.
How come I can't be the host? That seems more creative. Do you ever have that feeling where you get an idea and then you are inspired? You think it might be the best idea you've ever heard. You're in a vacuum of inspiration and you're just going to go for it. Does that resonate?
Not the best idea, but yeah, sometimes I think I got a pretty good idea.
You got a pretty good idea. Well, for whatever reason, sometime in after my 20s, I started getting hit with all these ideas. I created a syndicated comic strip and wrote 10 books and wrote a bunch of songs and whatever's happened at the New York Times. And I started to get interested in what that feeling was that drives so many people. And so I looked to science. And I look to great creators in the book. I talk to Yo-Yo Ma, Judd Apatow, Steve Kerr of the Warriors, you know, go down the list of all these great creators to figure out, is there something biological and fundamental about creativity? And what the heck is it?
Well, I want to spoil the answer here, but yes, it sounds like if I read you right, there is something in our, like as humans, in our DNA that makes creativity happen. Like you talk to scientists, why would we evolve to have this creativity?
Yeah. And I even went all the way into the lab looking at bacteria and how they respond when bombarded by a threat and how they create their way out of the situation. And without giving so much of it away, discovered ultimately that there is a deep biological underpinning to our creative urges and then traced that forward to how that plays out in our own lives.
All right. So we got little kids. They're creative as heck. We all are. But you write about something you call the fourth grade slump. What happens to us in fourth grade?
Yeah, I went and looked at this research that started about in the 1950s, where researchers were trying to figure out what makes us creative and what hampers our creativity. And it was a period of time, Rob, where we were beginning to ask as a society, what is this thing called creativity? We value it a lot. Why does it seem so elusive? And here's why. When you're a little kid, ideas flow through you without judgment. Somewhere around fourth grade, the research shows, creative explosions start to actually diminish. Now, why would that be? Well, it's right around this time that young people begin to internalize rules before they internalize impulses. So, Rob, when you're raising kids as I'm doing, and I don't know what your situation is, I promise not to ask any deeply personal questions.
I got a pair of them, first year of college.
You
now.
Got a pair. Okay, so do these sentences resonate? Don't run into the street. Don't pick your nose and eat it.
Careful
don't
on
eat
the
that
steps.
Off the floor. Tons of no's. And what it does is it conditions people to begin to say no before they begin to say yes. What is the rule that would impair me or interfere with me before I go forward? Here's the problem. Creativity at its core is an act of permission. It begins with allowing your mind to flow with ideas, oftentimes ideas that are against the status quo, against the rule system, run afoul of something you've heard. So you are conditioned from a very young age to begin to shut those down.
How do we break out of those rules?
Yeah, to be plain, this is not precisely a self-help book. This is more of a scientific journey, but I can't deny that in the end, the questions you ask are the very ones I sought to answer myself. And there are a bunch of tools we can use. I'll give you a couple of examples without going over all the studies in the book. One of them has to do with mind wandering. And believe it or not, this is something we often do and really dislike. So when people's mind wanders, actually, can I pause, Rob, and give you an exercise to explain what I mean by mind wandering?
Yeah, absolutely.
It will involve another deeply personal question.
Good, good.
Okay, here we go. Before you go to bed at night, don't kick me off the air.
I'm with you so far.
I'll say that I have these fantasies. I'm not talking about, you know, those kind of fantasies. I'm talking about various ideas that pop in my head and flow through my mind. I had a friend, for example, explain she likes to imagine herself flying. When I was a kid, I used to imagine myself in a sporting goods store where I could buy anything I wanted. Our family didn't have much money. Do you have anything like that you used to think about or think about before bed?
Oh, yeah, sure. But like, it's better if I just drift into it, though, than consciously think about it. I mean, there's different things. I like board games. I think about those a lot. I'll say
all kinds of things, okay? Now, you may not think about that as mind wandering. You may not think of that in any way as a creative impulse. But when those ideas flow through your mind without filter, that's a little bit what mind wandering feels like. Here's the thing that the research shows. It shows, one, that when your mind wanders, you often come up with ideas that may elude you otherwise. And in fact, I can cite in a second, if you want, how some great creators use that. But just for a second, take it on face. The problem, though, is that when people's mind wanders, they often stop it when they're in the middle of their day, because mind wandering sometimes goes to worry. And people feel they're being unproductive. So to cultivate that idea of permission means cultivating this idea of mind wandering and giving it a little bit more breath than we often do.
We're talking to Matt Richtel about his new book, Inspired, Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul. Let's bring out a caller at 800-642-1234. Jordan is with us in Antigo. Jordan, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on this afternoon.
What did you want to tell us about?
I attended a seminar working with youth programming and youth groups, and the presenter was talking about creativity in that mindset. And the point that he brought up was very interesting, is that creativity is not something you have to dredge up out of yourself. If you think of creativity as being an expectation plus a modification. And the example that he used was soccer. Two teams, one ball, two goals. That's the expectation. But now what happens when you add a second ball? Or you add two more teams and two more goals? Or two more goals but keep the same number of teams? And all of a sudden, you have this tree of possibilities that, to the outsider, looks spontaneous and creative. But really, it's just the two simple phases of an expectation and a modification.
Jordan, thanks for that call. Matt, that reminds me, in your book, you talked to a group of young folks and gave them take a normal thing and what if. What was their answer? Something like, what if you flushed the toilet and it traveled you into space? Or something to that effect. Yeah. Is there something what our caller is saying there?
Well, there's a few things I love about Jordan's call, but I want to tell him a visceral reaction I had and explain what the science is behind it. So when he said two balls, I was like, well, no, you can't do two balls in soccer. And here's some great science. It turns out, and this was a piece that appeared in the New York Times today that excerpted from the book about why we often resist creative ideas. So explicitly, we often say, I want to be creative. I want to hire someone who's creative. But there is an implicit note. But studies will show that when they look at our subconscious feelings about creativity, they're very different than the feelings we say we have. And in fact, we subconsciously associate creativity with toxins and vomit and poison. Well, why would that be? To trace it back to Jordan's question, when we challenge the status quo, it means that we're going to have to change the way we conceptualize something. We may have to change our activities, our actions. We may have to change our whole lifestyle. And in fact, Rob, creativity often is very disruptive. So it's worth noting that we have these reactions internally that sometimes get in the way of our creativity because secretly we harbor visceral concerns about it.
Jordan, thanks for that call. We're talking to Matt Richtel, science reporter for the New York Times, author of the new book just out today. It's called Inspired, Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Have you found ways to be more creative, maybe over the last couple few years in particular? Or do you think you hit a stage in your life where you lost something? You couldn't harness that creativity maybe you had as a little kid? Do you have questions for our guest about the science of creativity? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. That's the song From Darkness, written and sung by our guest Matt Richtel. We're talking to him about his new book, Inspired, Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have an example of how you use creativity in your life? Do you feel like you got to have some kind of creative outlet? Do you feel like you lost it at some point? And have you ever solved a problem when you stopped thinking about it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Now, there you are, Matt, writing a song and singing the song. You write fiction. You mentioned a comic strip. You're a science writer. That's your day job. And a lot of us might think, okay, I'm going to stay in my lane and not try all this stuff. Why encourage us to do some of the things you've done and branch out like that?
Oh, get out of your lane, baby. And if anybody wants to hear that full song, my email is mattrichtel@gmail.com, and I will send it to you. And I'm proud of it or I believe in it? Listen, believe in yourself. But let's guide me a little bit, Rob. Where do you want me to take this?
Like songwriting, I'm a musician, right? And I feel pretty good about my musical output. I am a god-awful songwriter. I tried once. The world didn't need to hear it. How could you tell somebody in that situation, yeah, Rob, go back and try writing another song? Everybody's got probably something similar to that, that they'd be too embarrassed to share it with the world.
This is my, well, let me start with some science and come back to that answer.
Yeah.
Because you alluded to this before, another interesting study. This one looked at artists, musicians, and physicists, and asked them to write down what they were doing when they solved a problem that they were trying, a creative problem they were trying to solve. And 20% of the time, they solved it when they weren't actively thinking about it. Now, that number may not seem so high, but the researcher said to me, how many things can you point to that you actually do at your very best when you're not trying? This is an idea that came to me from a variety of creators I talked to. Gary Trudeau, who created Doonesbury, gets his ideas in the shower, and Jane Pauley, his wife, keeps a pad of paper by her bed and scribbles down the ideas when she wakes up. Salvador Dali and Einstein used to take a nap with a rock or heavy object in their hands, and when they woke up, they would have an idea at the tip of their minds. The researcher calls it a hypnagogic state between wakefulness and sleep. To answer your question, Rob, if you sat down to say, I'm going to write a song right now, I think that's putting yourself in a very difficult position. If you were to carry with yourself the idea that I'm playing with music right now and I am open to song ideas coming to me, eventually I feel very certain they would emerge. And here's why. Over time, Rob, you have internalized the shape of a song. That is not elusive to you. Verse, chorus, or verse, verse, chorus, verse, chorus. Moreover, you know how long it is, 3.5 minutes, and you know that you're probably going to use 1, 4, and 5. Sorry, those are chord progressions for those of you listening. So a lot of this has been solved. I say put it in the back of your mind and see what happens.
Excellent. Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Joy is with us in Monona. Joy, hi.
How are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Joy?
Good. I have a question that I'm going to try to make succinct. It's kind of a large area, but I'm wondering if Matt, your guest, has looked into or studied morphic resonance. It's a concept brought up by Rupert Sheldrake, an English thinker in, I think, the 60s. And anyway, it's about the concept that there's a kind of a universal unconsciousness or unconscious in the world, and that is where ideas come from. It's called morphic resonance, and it's really fascinating. And two quick examples to give you an idea of how this works is that there's records of researchers working with different kinds of monkeys around the world, and they were trying to get, one study was trying to get a matriarch to take her bananas down to the water and wash them, and then hopefully her whole clan would follow suit. Well, she wouldn't do it, she refused. But then around the world they started getting calls from researchers saying, what's going on, our matriarch, our alpha male female is taking her bananas down to water and washing them before she eats them. And now the whole group is doing that.
Joy, thanks for the example. We don't have a ton of time, but Matt, I'm not familiar with that idea, but the general idea that there is this pool of ideas out there that any of us might tap into at a given moment.
Yeah. I mean, I actually think Joy brings up a really interesting point without having studied that particular language. And I'll tie it to some science I can validate for you. There have been periods of time in human history where specific areas of the world have been really rich with creativity. Jerusalem at the year zero, Harlem, Russia, Florence, France, Silicon Valley, Hollywood. What the research will bear out is that when you have certain connections among people that are dense, you wind up getting cooperation, collaboration, competition, and ideas are in the air that really intensify the creative process. Now, that may not sound like the same thing as what Joy's describing, but in a way, it's a more physical description of how the subconscious becomes flowing through a population. I would just add, Rob, that you could make a pretty good case that we are at the most creative period in human history. And one of the reasons for that is that technology is allowing those ideas to be shared across borders, among people, across interest groups and niches. Just listen to this simple statistic. In 2018, there were 144,000 patents applied for by international collaborators. That's a little less than double from the number in 2000. So we're seeing an explosion of that kind of cooperation across the globe.
We are talking to Matt Richtel about his new book out today called Inspired: Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul. Matt, earlier you mentioned that deep down, a lot of us are actually kind of scared of creativity, of novelty, of having to change the way we do things. So if someone is in charge of something, a teacher, a business manager, whatever, and they think they want creativity, how do they actually create a setting where people do get to be creative and run with it?
I just want to say that is a hugely great question that vexes scholars. And they will say that the middle managers are in one of the toughest positions and managers in all of the world. In fact, some of the research will show that when people are most in need of solutions, they're least able to accept them because the status quo feels safe at a time of great uncertainty. And so I think what it requires in the first instance is an acknowledgement that there must be a safe space for the expression of those ideas wherein the manager or leader agrees not to feel threatened by what happens. And some of those ideas will be terrible. In fact, one of the lessons of the biology of creativity and of creativity itself is that the most creative people, Einstein and Mozart and lots of others, were much better at quantity than they were at quality. There's a terrific story about Einstein that I heard where he says to a colleague, I've got it. I've got the unified field theory. And the colleague says, Albert, that's terrific, except under that theory, the universe can't exist. And people who create a lot come up with a lot of ideas, and some of them are terrible, and others are too scary, and some of them are just right, if you like your three bears analogy. And so that's what I would encourage leaders to create a safe space and recognize that quantity is where quality comes from.
It's a great place to leave it. Matt, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's New York Times science journalist Matt Richtel with us today to talk about his new book, just came out today. It's called Inspired, Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul. You can share your stories of creativity. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email centraltime@WPR.org. You can call it a comeback. Earlier this month, the state DNR, Madison Audubon, and the Milwaukee County's Parks Department shared that an active bald eagle nest had been documented in Milwaukee County. That means that nests have been confirmed in all 72 of Wisconsin's counties, a recovery milestone for an iconic raptor that numbered only 107 in 1974. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been involved with any organized efforts to observe, document, or otherwise help the recovery of bald eagles in Wisconsin? What did you do? What did you learn doing that? In general, do you spot bald eagles in your neck of the woods? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We're going to talk about some of the science and ecology of the comeback. First, we wanted to learn about the historical and cultural significance of bald eagles from one indigenous perspective. Kathy Smith is an enrolled tribal member with the Keweenaw Bay Indian Community of the Lake Superior Band of Chippewa Indians. She works with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. She's the Manoman Ganawindong, or she who takes care of the wild rice. Kathy, welcome to Central Time.
Bonjour.
I know there are a lot of different native perspectives on the bald eagle. From yours, can you tell us about the meaning of bald eagles in your culture?
Well, the eagle is known as Migizi in Ojibwe Mawin, which is our language. And as for eagles, the eagle has a symbol of power and strength, you know, for thousands of years. Eagles are known for their sharp vision, a keen sense of perception, powers of intuition. Eagles also represent action, resolve, and grace, and with great strength, leadership, and vision. The eagle clan also represents, you know, family unit. Both parents, you know, protect and bring food to the eaglets. The eagle, you know, in Ojibwe, people believe that the members of this bird clan pursue the highest elevations of the mind, just as the eagle pursues the highest elevations of the sky. The bird can fly high in the sky, observing the world at great distance. And the eagle is known to be the closest to Geje Manadu, who is the creator, as part of the sky world, and can access his or her wisdom. You know, with our ceremonies, they are the ones that lift the smoke to the creator. As we are filling our asima, or our pipes, and we smoke it with our songs, petitions, and prayers. They're also known as spiritual messengers. Eagles are the keepers of knowledge and responsible for spreading the seeds of that knowledge.
With all that, what does it mean to you to see bald eagles after hitting such a low point, in part because of pesticides and a lot of other factors, the bald eagle making a comeback all over the state?
Well, the sight of an eagle is, you know, really exciting. When we see one, we always say, oh my goodness, there's a Migizi. So when we are at those low points, you know, it's a way of uplifting each other and ourselves, you know, so we always put that asima down, that tobacco, you know, when you petition that eagle. And, you know, it's They're telling us to be courageous and to dream of a flying eagle or even perched, you know, high signifies, you know, good fortune or victory coming our way.
I've been fortunate enough to see an eagle feather ceremony at a powwow. Can you talk about the significance of eagle feathers?
The significance of our eagle feathers is a symbol of honor and to give someone or to gift someone, you know, who achieves a task. You know, even in our modern times, you know, I'm part of our Keweenaw Bay Ojibwe Community College. We always give them, you know, at such beautiful events as a graduation from a college or a speaker. You know, if they do beautiful work, even with the youth, we always gift an eagle feather in a good way.
It's an amazing thing to see an eagle firsthand in nature. Do you have a personal memory or experience witnessing eagles that you'd like to share with us?
Oh, I do a lot of work with Nibi, with the water. And as we do our water walk in our community at the Keweenaw Bay Indian Community, we have an annual walk. And just as, you know, we finish this walk, we always see not one, but a few eagles, you know, at the end of our walk. And it just shows a beautiful way of, you know, ending our ceremony and how, you know, it brings our community together and to be able to uplift us, you know, at the end of our walk and to see not one or two, maybe three. And it's just a beautiful way, you know, to end a walk, you know, with that victorious symbolism.
And I know we'll talk to our next guest. The DNR has guidelines about how to not get too close to eagles' nests and show some respect for them. Can you leave us, Kathy, with some thoughts on, you know, appreciating eagles and respecting them when we see them in the wild?
We always have to have that balance, you know, to honor the eagles in a good way. You know, it's part of our stories, part of our culture, and it always teaches us much wisdom and knowledge. And so, you know, we use that also in our teachings from right and wrong. We also use the animals or even stories of the Migizi. And with our seven grandfather teachings with Migizi, it also represents love. You know, so it's also bringing that community together for those gentle reminders.
Kathy, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Oh, miigwech.
That's Kathy Smith. Kathy works with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission and is an enrolled member of the Keweenaw Bay Indian Community. Now we'll take a look at the ecological history of the return of bald eagles in Wisconsin. Again, now confirmed active nests in all 72 Wisconsin counties. Richard Stafen is with us, conservation biologist and zoologist with the Natural Heritage Program of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Rich, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
How excited were you when you heard the news, number 72, now the 72nd county with an active bald eagle nest?
Yeah, certainly I was pretty excited. I mean, I think our whole program and most of the people in the DNR were excited to hear the news. We've been waiting for that last county to be checked off in Milwaukee. So to get the 72 of our counties now is really a great accomplishment.
Let's look back at the road to this recovery. It wasn't guaranteed to come out this way. The early 1970s, a low point for bald eagles around the country, including in Wisconsin. Can you talk about how low the numbers got then and what brought them there?
Yeah, certainly. You mentioned before one of the main factors in those declining numbers was the use of DDT and other pesticides across the country that had major impacts on a lot of our birds of prey or raptors, including the bald eagle. The number, we started our survey in Wisconsin. It's one of the longest running eagle and osprey surveys in the country. And we started ours in 1973. And at that time, the number of nesting pairs in Wisconsin was 107. It's possible that the numbers might have even been a little bit lower in previous years in the state. The numbers kind of hit their lowest point in the 50s and 60s when DDT was prevalent across the country. And in the continental U.S., the lower 48 states at that time, the estimated number of nesting pairs was as low as 417 in the 50s and 60s. So super low numbers compared to where we are today. And historically, I've seen some estimates in the 1500s and 1600s of eagle nesting eagles in the lower 48, as high as 100,000 nesting eagles in the lower 48 states. So quite a huge decline in numbers. And to put that into some perspective, now the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service came up with an estimate in 2021, we're back to around 71,500 nesting pairs in the lower 48 states. So we're getting back close to those historical numbers, but yeah, still a little ways to go. But yeah, we're on the right path.
Getting rid of DDT, a big part of the solution. What were some of the other concrete steps that may have contributed to that comeback?
Yeah, certainly habitat protection is a big one. So the birds, the eagles need large canopy trees, canopy white pines near water bodies for nesting, other large trees, and some of the bottomland forest areas along rivers. We see them nesting in cottonwoods a lot, so protecting some of those large trees. And then just the Clean Water Act and protecting some of our waterways to get them back into a much more usable condition for eagles and many other wildlife species and fish that eagles and osprey prey on was also a key factor in their recovery.
We're talking to Rich Stafen, conservation biologist and zoologist with the Natural Heritage Program at the State DNR. We're talking about the recovery story of bald eagles in Wisconsin. An inhabited nest was documented recently in Milwaukee County, meaning now there have been confirmed nests in all 72 counties in the state. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. Where do you go to see bald eagles? Are you seeing more of them now as opposed to a few years ago, 10 years ago? Is there more that you'd like to see done in terms of federal, state, local efforts to protect and conserve the bald eagle population here in the state? Share your questions about bald eagles, your sightings at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation about bald eagles and their comeback here in Wisconsin, now sighted, active nests sighted in all 72 counties. Rich Stafen is with us, conservation biologist and zoologist of the Natural Heritage Program at the State Department of Natural Resources. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about the bald eagle comeback in the state. Maybe your sightings. Have you seen bald eagles where you didn't used to? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go to your calls now. Cordy is with us in Frederick. Cordy, hi.
Hello, how are you? It's always good to be to hear your show. I listen to it daily.
Yay. What did you want to tell us about, Cordy?
Well, I wanted to share with you that back in 1966, my late grandfather bought a 120-acre property up here in West Sweden Township in Polk County. And for the last 20 years, we've had abundant eagles here. I love to watch them all throughout the year. It's so neat to watch those babies grow up and to watch how all those eagles interact. And even though the eagles do eat the abundant population of trumpet or swan babies, I mean, they try to get them, but I am so glad the eagles are here, and I don't want to take them for granted, and I think we should continue to protect them however we can, just like, you know, every protected creature. Sometimes what happens is we start to see a lot of them, and then people get irritated by them, and then they want to not protect them anymore, but I think God has a way of working things out so they all thrive together.
Cordy, I got to ask, you've been watching maybe the same eagles for a long time. Can you attach sort of faces to the same eagle as they grow up? Do you have names for them?
Actually, I do that with the swans, okay, but not with the eagles. The eagles are just interesting to watch, and they're always preying on everything, and we'd love to watch them, and we appreciate them.
Gotcha.
They're so powerful, you know, getting through the winter all year and all that stuff.
Got it. Cordy, thanks a lot for joining us. Rich, do you want to hear from people like Cordy, their reports when they see eagles in their community, long or short term?
Yeah, the one thing that we tell people in terms of eagle reporting is we're mostly interested in eagle nests. So when people see a nest that they drive a particular road every day, and they drive that road in the springtime, and they see a nest that they hadn't seen before. So the possibility that it's a new nest, or if there's a nest that seems kind of small still to them, that also is a good sign that it's a new eagle nest. Those are the ones we're particularly interested in. We think we have a pretty good assessment or count on most of the eagle nests in the state. So we're really interested in potentially new ones that we don't have accounted for. And by reporting them to us, we can put them into our rare species database then that actually it protects them. So if there was any kind of development or some kind of other disturbance that might take place near a nest, we know about where the nest is and we can better protect it that way.
Thanks for the call, Cordy. And I mentioned earlier, we see an eagle's nest, great, but we don't want to disturb it. How do we make sure we don't bug the eagles while they're nesting?
Well, the one nice thing or great thing about eagles is they've become even more tolerant of people, it seems like. So with this recovery, we're seeing them nesting in areas that are getting closer and closer to people and urban areas in the city of Madison here in Milwaukee County, like you've documented. So they are fairly tolerant of people. And in most cases, when they choose to nest in a location that is a high activity area or where there's lots of people around, it doesn't seem to bother them. In some more remote areas where they're not as used to people, there's some setbacks or buffers that we recommend for several different activities. But if somebody were to be out walking, typically we would say that if you're trying to stay at least a couple hundred feet away from a nest, and you usually know if you're too close by to a nest, if the bird would actually fly up off of the nest and would start calling or squawking, that's usually a pretty good sign that you're too close to the nest. So
let's go back.
Take a few and watch them at a safe distance.
Let's go back to our callers. Tom is with us in Luxembourg. Tom, hi.
Hi. I read several articles lately that eagles of all birds of prey and scavengers are being affected by the lead shot and lead bullets and eating geese that are grabbing sinkers when they're feeding. Does the DNR have any plans to outlaw lead in hunting and fishing?
Tom, thanks for the call. I know this is a long-time concern, Rich. Lead used in hunting and fishing, finding its way into eagles and other birds of prey.
Yeah, it's certainly a major concern. It's actually not one of the leading causes of death for eagles, but it is one of the top three or four causes of death for eagles. And it, if you talk to a rehabilitator, they'll describe the horror of seeing an eagle that's suffering from lead poisoning or dying from lead poisoning. At this time, the DNR does not, that I'm aware of, have any plans to outlaw lead and ammunition or tackle. I think it's up to the folks that hunt and fish to try, and there are alternatives out there that, we would recommend that they would try and shift over to some of those copper bullets or other forms of tackle to reduce the threat that it would cause to eagles and other raptors.
Tom, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Richard Stafen with the state DNR, talking about the comeback of the Wisconsin bald eagle. Well, I guess they're not just Wisconsin bald eagles, but of the bald eagle in Wisconsin, now active nests spotted in all 72 counties. Back to your calls now. John is with us in Two Rivers. John, hi.
Hi. We moved to Two Rivers about 50 years ago, and I bought a lot from a farmer who had retired and lotted off his hay field. And when I bought it, we got to know him a little bit. And he said, well, you know, you're going to notice there's no reptiles out here. There's no frogs or snakes or anything like that, and very few birds. And he said, that's because of we used DDT for 50 years and it's still in the soil. And I guess probably in the river behind my house, the fish were all dead because there was a cheese factory up north of us. And they dumped away in the river, and the bacteria growth killed all fish. So the fish started coming back probably 20, 25 years ago. And about 10 years ago, I noticed an eagle every spring would get a couple of them flying up and down the river. And I never could see where they nest because they fly up into the woods. But the eagle, there's at least one or two of them every year in the spring. And then 2 or 3 years ago, my yard is now in spring is covered with frogs. Huh. And it's just amazed me at how nature can recover from all that abuse.
John, thanks for the call. Rich, maybe an encouraging story there. Doing, changing the way we do stuff can bring back some of that wildlife.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable how stuff can recover and rebound after some major setbacks like that. And I think we see that in some of our other bird populations, too. We talk a lot about the 3 billion birds lost that we've documented or has been documented. But there are other birds that are doing fairly well, like raptors and waterfowl and some of the species that humans can help with nesting nest boxes or nesting platforms or other activities that have kind of staved off some of those declines that we see in other birds. And some of the other ones and some of these ones are doing well. So we can play a role in recovery and helping populations kind of persist and see through some of these tough times.
John, thanks for sharing that firsthand report from your own yard. I appreciate it. We heard on the Ideas Network Facebook page from Claudia, who writes, here in Milwaukee County, we're lucky enough to have eagles in the city of Milwaukee and Bayview. Sadly, the female eagle of the pair has passed away from bird flu just recently, but has had one hatchling make it so far. And I wanted to ask you, Rich, how worried are we? And we're very worried about bird flu in general. How worried are we for bald eagles in particular?
Yeah, they're particularly susceptible to avian influenza. So it's definitely something that we're monitoring closely, our wildlife health folks and other people in the field. I think raptors in general, waterfowl are, yeah, definitely at risk. So I think there are major concerns about this and probably more so than, yeah, any other thing right now is, yeah, to continue to monitor what kind of impacts it's going to have on our eagle population.
And Rich, in just our last minute or so, if people want to go out and see bald eagles this time of year, I know the Wisconsin River has a lot of sites we can go to. Where do we have our best chances of seeing eagles?
Yeah, certainly you hit it on the head there, the Wisconsin River. Some of our major water bodies, rivers, Mississippi River, Chippewa River, Black River, there's eagles nesting there. Some of the highest density of nesting eagles in the state is in the north central part in Vilas and Oneida County, and then in southwestern Wisconsin, Crawford and Grant counties, along those major rivers, and up north it's along some of our numerous water bodies like lakes and ponds and stuff up there too.
Rich, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Richard Stafen is a conservation biologist and zoologist with the Natural Heritage Program of Wisconsin's Department of Natural Resources, with us today to talk about the comeback of bald eagles in the state after the discovery of an inhabited nest in Milwaukee County, marking the bird's return to all 72 of the state's counties.